again with his brother Phil and others, broke into a General Electric nuclear missile plant in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania, in the first Plowshares action. The most recent Plowshares action took place this past April 4th, on the 50th anniversary of Dr. Martin Luther King's assassination, when seven Catholic Plowshares activists entered the Kings Bay Naval Base in Georgia, the largest nuclear submarine base in the world. They were armed with just hammers, crime tape, and baby bottles containing their own blood. One of the seven is Elizabeth McAllister, the widow of Philip Berrigan, a priest at the time he led the Catonsville action 50 years ago. And that does it for today's show. If you'd like to get a copy, go to democracynow.org, and there our video and audio podcasts, as well as our transcripts are. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Massoud, Sharina Nadura, Nat Needham, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, and Paul Huckabee, our engineer. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, and Dennis Moynihan.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Pandit Ramdas Palsule Tabla Show on Friday, June 1st at 7:30 p.m. at the Levin Community Center in Portland. Ramdas Palsule is an accomplished soloist as well as a versatile accompanist on the tabla who has performed widely in the eminent music festivals of India and all over the world. Again, that's the Pandit Ramdas Palsule Tabla Show on Friday, June 1st at 7:30 p.m. at the Levin Community Center, 5431 Northeast 20th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. Join KBOO and Kofallen Cultural Center on Thursday, June 14th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater for an evening of storytelling, live music, and film. Malian artist, author, and storyteller Baba Wage Jakite starts with a talk on the background of the Empire of Mali and the role of West Africa's oral historians before the screening of Keita, Heritage of the Griots, a film which blends modern events with magical realism, mythology, and history. Again, that's an evening of the culture of Mali, including the screening of the film Keita, Heritage of the Griots, on Thursday, June 14th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Portland.
This is KBOO Portland. Coming up this morning at 9, the Old Mole Variety Hour burrows down to the roots of the great issues of our times. At 10, Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein looks back at Mount St. Helens 38 years after the eruption with Charlie Cresafulli, who's been conducting research on the mountain since 1980. At 11, Making Contact also looks back to 1980 and the Gwangju Uprising in South Korea that ended an era of martial law and military dictatorship. And at 11:30, Voices for the Animals talks to Stephen Wise, the founder of the Non-Human Rights Project. Thanks, KBOO members, for your support. To keep informed and to get involved, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by the KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Northwest String Summit, now in their 17th year, providing family-friendly music camping festival featuring Greenski Bluegrass, Yonder Mountain String Band, and many more, July 19th through July 22nd at Horning's Hideout in North Plains. For tickets and more information, please visit stringsummit.com.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, the Garifuna, an Afro-Caribbean people, struggle for their land and their culture. Our guest is Alfredo Lopez. He is the vice president of the Black Fraternal Organization of Honduras. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. A day after canceling his planned summit with North Korea's leader, Donald Trump has welcomed the North's response that it's still willing to meet. In a tweet this morning, Trump called the North's reaction warm and productive and expressed hope for a long and enduring prosperity and peace. The North Korean vice foreign minister called Trump's decision unexpected and very regrettable, and said the cancellation of the talks shows how grave the status of historically deep-rooted hostile North Korea-U.S. relations is and how urgently a summit should be realized to improve ties. Senate Foreign Relations Committee member Democrat Ben Cardin told CNN Trump's cancellation was puzzling and potentially dangerous.
I think everyone understands that the only way to resolve this is through diplomacy. There is no military option without extreme risks. So it's puzzling that the president has now thrown diplomacy off track, and there's always a risk of a miscalculation.
South Korean leaders said they, too, were puzzled by Trump's decision, which came days after President Moon Jae-in met with Trump in Washington to try to promote the talks. The South Korean unification minister said his country would continue its bilateral negotiations with the North. The remarks were broadcast on Al Jazeera.
As for Vice Foreign Minister Kim's statement, we see no change of a sincere will by the relevant countries when it comes to resolving the current situation through dialogue. The government will continue our diplomatic efforts to further extend this momentum for the talks.
Earlier, Trump said from the White House that a maximum pressure campaign of economic sanctions and diplomatic isolation would continue against North Korea, with which the U.S. is technically still at war. But he added it was possible the summit could take place at some point. Donald Trump is not backing down on his unproven claim that the FBI planted a spy in his presidential campaign. In a series of tweets, Trump quotes in part a conservative editor who said that, quote, everyone knows there was a spy, and in fact, the people who were involved in the spying are admitting that there was a spy. That's inaccurate. No one involved in the investigation of possible collusion between Trump's presidential campaign and Russia has made any such statement. Trump's comments came after Republican and Democratic lawmakers received rare classified briefings about the origins of the FBI probe into Russian meddling in the 2016 presidential election. Ranking Intelligence Committee Democrat Adam Schiff was among those briefed. He made brief comments afterwards.
Nothing we heard today has changed our view that there is no evidence to support any allegation that the FBI or any intelligence agency placed a spy in the Trump campaign or otherwise failed to follow appropriate procedures and protocols.
Democrats expressed grave concern about the presence of White House lawyer Emmett Flood at the meetings, although he reportedly left after offering a statement and did not stay for the actual briefing. New York Democrat Jerry Nadler, who did not attend either meeting, slammed the FBI for submitting to the president's demand to brief lawmakers about its investigation into the president. Other Democrats used words like dictator and fascist while referring to Trump. Here's Democrat Hank Johnson of Georgia.
Our government is not a government of, by, and for the dictator. Our government is of, by, and for the people. In America, no person, not even the President of the United States, is above the law. Yet every day we wake up to new and more disturbing reports about President Trump and his accomplices in Congress putting their thumbs on the scale of justice in an attempt to stop the Mueller investigation.
Former movie mogul Harvey Weinstein arrived at a New York City courthouse in handcuffs to face rape and other charges. Weinstein turned himself in at a police precinct earlier. Police say he was arrested on rape, Criminal Sex Act, sex abuse, and sexual misconduct charges in cases involving two women. Scores of women have made accusations against him. Weinstein consistently has denied any allegations of non-consensual sex. Voters throughout Ireland have begun casting votes in a referendum that may lead to a loosening of the country's strict ban on most abortions. The referendum will decide whether the Eighth Amendment of the Constitution is repealed, which would open the way for more liberal legislation. The amendment in place since 1983 gives a fetus and even a fertilized egg from the moment of conception equal rights to that of the pregnant woman. The Catholic Church was behind the amendment and is campaigning against repeal. If Ireland votes in favor of repeal, new abortion laws will then be discussed in Parliament. The government is proposing that terminations be allowed during the first 12 weeks of pregnancy, later abortions to be allowed in special cases. I'm Eileen Alfandari. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
That was our news headlines. This is Margaret Prescott, and today we are delighted to have in studio Alfredo Lopez. He is the vice president of the Black Fraternal Organization of Honduras, an organization dedicated to fighting for the rights of the Garifuna people in Honduras. He is a Garifuna himself and a leading activist for the Garifuna community. Alfredo Lopez, welcome.
Thank you. Es un placer estar aquí. Muchísimas gracias.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much.
Y la verdad es que estamos muy
We're very pleased to be here. We want to give a shout out to everyone who's listening to us this morning. Thank you so much.
Alfredo Lopez, we'll start out by talking about who are the Garifuna. Where did they originate and what Central American countries they're based?
The Garifuna people were 200,000 people along the Central American coastline of Honduras.
My understanding is that the Garifuna originated in the Caribbean island of St. Vincent, which initially was an English-speaking colony sometime around the 17th century. Is that right, or were there other Caribbean islands from where the Garifuna also hailed, or is it mainly St. Vincent?
That's correct. So this new people, we have an origin that dates back to the 1600s. With the Africans that came on the slave ships, there was a rebellion that happened at the stop in St. Vincent. And, you know, the Africans who were destined to become enslaved in the slave trade rebelled. The Africans then fled the slave ships and they reached a small island where indigenous fisher people rescued the Africans and brought them to St. Vincent.
Wow, that's quite a story. And I'd have to say we have to thank Jeanette Charles of the Chiapas Support Group doing our translation, our interpretation today. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, and our guest in studio, Alfredo Lopez, vice president of the Black Fraternal Organization of Honduras. And he is himself a Garifuna. Alfredo, although there is a pretty sizable Garifuna population here in Southern California, a lot of people, even from other parts of the Caribbean, as well as Black people in the United States, don't really know a whole heck of a lot about the Garifuna. And that's one of the reasons I'm asking you about some of this history. And also, a lot of people are only slowly learning about the level of resistance and rebellion by slaves who were brought over. One story we heard is that the Garifuna were expelled from St. Vincent, but clearly there was a battle that happened as the slavers were bringing them into St. Vincent. Just give us a bit more context.
Desde luego que sí. Nosotros somos un pueblo.
Our people never arrived to the slave markets, and for better or worse, we have remained in permanent resistance till today. I want to tell you all that the community here, the Garifuna community here, is very important, and the majority of them are from Belize, and very many of them are relatives of ours. And, you know, we've been in a constant wave of migration. The Garifuna reached Honduras in 1797 due to the massive expulsion that occurred after the assassination of our maximum leader, Joseph Satuye. And we arrived to the island of Roatan off the coast of Honduras, which at that time was an English protectorate. So many of our brothers and sisters, after reaching Honduras in 1797, began to migrate to Guatemala, so in Livingston, Nicaragua, and Belize, searching for better conditions than what they found in Honduras, where we suffered under a racist government, which continues today, and also in Guatemala and other places. Many people reached Belize, and now you have cities like Dangriga and Hopkins that have entire Garifuna communities. The only difference is that the Garifuna there mix Garifuna in English, whereas we in Honduras mix Garifuna in Spanish because our forefathers stayed in Honduras. Today, we have large populations of Garifuna in New York, New Orleans, and Houston. And history is very interesting. Despite our massive migration, we've been able to maintain our nuclear families. And so our roots and our traditions, such as our culture and our spirituality, have maintained themselves across time and geography. And we use our culture and our spirituality as tools to defend and struggle against this economic system that becomes worse each day.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, and our guest is Alfredo Lopez Garifuna from Honduras. He's the vice president of the Black Fraternal Organization of Honduras, and our interpreter is Jeanette Charles, who is with the Chiapas Support Group. We are now going to continue our discussion with Alfredo Lopez, who joined us in studio. Alfredo, you talked about the Garifuna arriving in Honduras and then spreading out from Honduras to Belize, to Guatemala. And I actually had the opportunity when I was in Guatemala to visit Livingston and the Garifuna community there. I wanted to ask how much, because we know that the language now, as you say, is a mix of Garifuna and Spanish in Honduras. In Belize, a mix of, well, a mix of several things, including English.
Go ahead.
Tell us a bit about how you were able to maintain your language and some of your cultural and spiritual practices. We know for those of us enslaved who were brought to an island like Barbados, where I'm from, where we have lost our language and still holding on to some of the old African traditions, but they really had to go underground. Similarly for here in the United States. So how did you, the Garifuna, manage to maintain that up against a very, very powerful repressive force or forces?
Precisamente esa es la pregunta que se hacen los funcionarios.
This is precisely the same question that many of our government officials have asked us in terms of how we find the strength to continue defending our land and our rights. One of the most important things, like I've mentioned before, is just that we've been able to maintain our families together. And that way we've been able to dialogue and to understand each other and continue working together. And despite the efforts of many strong political elites, they haven't been able to divide our families and our communities. And so we haven't lost our mother tongue. We've done a very specific strategic work to maintain our roots, particularly through alternative media and our community radio programs. We've been able to establish 5 community radios in 5 communities. In total, we're 46 Garifuna communities along the Honduran Caribbean coast. And our community radios have been able to influence our population so that we continue to speak our language up until today, which is so intrinsic to our people and our struggle for land. We cannot adopt a language that's foreign to us, that has nothing to do with our culture. And this is a very strong message that we're sending. And it's a very important source of our hope and our struggle. And it's been part of the reason why we've been able to weave networks to defend our lands and to prove that this political system is attacking us and repressing us. Some of the ideas that, for example, are coming out include the Charter Cities model, which is something that was inspired by New York economist Paul Romer, which he sold to the state of Honduras, which privatizes our land.
Right, and we'll get to some of what is happening today in Honduras and with the Garifuna community. I did want to ask you, though, about the relationship, historic as well as today, between the Garifuna community in Honduras and the First Nations or indigenous people, although clearly the Garifuna are also indigenous. There's some discussion about the definition of indigenous and how much, in terms of even family relationships over the years, there have been with indigenous people, or how many Garifuna people are also part indigenous or vice versa. I was fortunate enough to spend some time in Guatemala. I found that the racism was very strong in Guatemala against people of African descent, but also against indigenous people. The biggest insult was to call somebody negra or indio. and also similarly in Peru. The racism against black people in Peru was like Mississippi back in the 1930s, just really horrific. But there's also a very strong black community in Peru that have held on. And a number of the black people in Peru are also very dark skin. In fact, it's one of the only places I've been to where beauty is defined, and the black community, by how black you are. The darker you are, the more beautiful you're considered. And that is kind of a flip to what we see in other places of people trying to lighten their skin and all that sort of thing. So I just wanted you to comment on that.
Lo que pasa en esta situación, querida compañera.
So the situation, my dear friend, is that there's so much ignorance, and, you know, people think that because of someone's skin color that they can belittle them or minimize them. And there's really no scientific or legal route as to say why someone's skin color should determine their social status or class. When the colonialists or colonizers came to Latin America, they came and they came to steal all of our resources, our gold and our minerals. And they left behind this false legacy of this history. And they don't want us to understand the realities that we face today. We do know that in Latin America, there's a great mix of people. But that shouldn't determine that people are considered less than due to the color of their skin. And, you know, for example, I've even come to face significant racism. And actually, when I was coming here to the U.S., the immigration officer asked me why my passport photo was so dark. And one of the things that I told him was that in Honduras, one is that there's a lot of sun. And so, you know, I'm also out a lot and I'm at the marches and I'm protesting. And so, you know, last month I've been doing a lot of that as well. And so in my passport photo, I come out darker too. And even in the couple of weeks I've been here, I've noticed that my skin's gotten a little lighter because of the climate. And so, you know, also one factor is that, you know, skin color is also really impacted by the different climates that we live in. But that shouldn't define or change what people perceive, because each of us are human beings that have ideas, thoughts, and principles, and that doesn't change. And there's a lot of ignorance, you know, oftentimes, too, as we see people who are even darker than me who will insult one another by saying, you know, negro in a diminutive way. But that, you know, we shouldn't take the word negro to mean that we're devaluing each other. It shouldn't be used in that way. So those of us who are studying this phenomenon come to realize that we need to change our values. And we need to realize that people are born with rights, and that doesn't make anyone less of a person because of our skin color. So everyone should receive the same respect. And a lot of people just don't understand that. So we oftentimes use spaces like the radio to explain this to our communities and try and change people's attitudes and inform people, because you can only go in life so long making these mistakes. And at one point you need to realize and come to face the truth, because the truth is what will make us free.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, and our in-studio guest is Alfredo Lopez, vice president of the Black Fraternal Organization of Honduras, an organization dedicated to defending the rights of the Garifuna people in Honduras. They're people of African descent. He himself is a Garifuna and a leading activist for the Garifuna community. We are now going to continue our discussion with Alfredo. I would want you to talk a bit about the relationships between the Garifuna community and the indigenous communities in Honduras.
En efecto, en Honduras somos nueve pueblos culturalmente diferenciados.
So in effect, there are nine culturally differentiated or indigenous peoples in Honduras, and we're in permanent relationship with each other. We all realize that we are discriminated equally by these great economic powers, and we've come to the consensus that together we can make difference and make changes. But there's always an effort on behalf of the government and the elites to try and divide and separate us. With the assassination of Berta Cáceres, her assassination provoked a great coming together across all of our peoples. And we've taken on the task of organizing against our repressive government, and also taking on this struggle in the face of death squads, you know, that are looking to assassinate us and pick us off one by one. and her death was really a devastating blow to us. Particularly with Ofrane, we've organized with the Lenca people, which is another indigenous nation of which Berta was the founder of Copin. We've organized with their organization for about 25 years.
Right. And of course, Berta Cáceres, an indigenous environmental activist and human rights activist, shot dead inside her home on March 2nd, 2016, just a few days before her 46th birthday. She had been under threat, and she, Copin, the Council of Indigenous and Popular Organizations of Honduras, also another member of Copin, comrade of Berta Cáceres, Nelson Garcia, was also assassinated on just a couple of weeks after Berta on March 15th. He was a father of five. And as was referenced, Cáceres was awarded the Goldman Environmental Prize. She had been receiving a lot of threats to her life, but people felt that because she won prizes, because she was internationally known, that it offered her some protection. Clearly, that was not the case. So we are going back and forth a little bit in time and history, but that's quite all right. So not to worry about that. I'm very glad that you raised the assassination of Berta, and we were also able, you know, to mention Nelson Garcia as well. Alfredo, I do want to ask, though, we know that in a place like Southern California, there's a huge population of people of Mexican descent, as in many places across the United States. It is only now emerging that there's a large swath of the population of Mexico today that have some African blood. And in Latin America, Central America, a lot of that history and mixing hidden. When the late Hugo Chavez, the president of Venezuela, said, yes, I have African blood in me, he was one of the first that I had heard of a prominent leader in the region that owned African descent. I'm wondering how much people, the Garifuna community in Honduras, know about people of African descent in Mexico. I don't know if there's any interaction. We know that in terms of the migration, many people fleeing the repression in Honduras, you know, travel through Mexico, getting to the U.S. border, and including a lot of the children who then the United States has turned around and deported. But I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that, because this is almost a hidden history that certainly people of African descent living in the United States, much less anybody else, know very little about. So I apologize for spending some time talking about this. We are going to have get to your struggles today, but I just wanted to make sure we use the occasion of your being here to draw out as much of that as we possibly can.
Desde luego que sí, Margaret, y es un placer responderte.
Really, it's a great pleasure to answer your questions, Margaret. Like I said earlier, and I want to just briefly touch on this again, is that there's so much ignorance across the world, and you know, a lot of things that people don't understand, and one of the biggest things people don't understand is that the world really began in Africa, and that's where we all came from. That was the first world here. It was like Eden, and a lot of people don't understand that. And when I actually came here last and I was in Minneapolis, I spoke with a professor at a university about it, and we talked about how the birthplace of mankind is Africa, and little by little, people traveling across the world. There were physical changes because of different climates. But those are one of the things that people don't understand and don't want to, and one of the things that media doesn't want to talk about. Because really, if people understood this history, it wouldn't be so easy for them to distinguish us and to divide us. One of the things is that we do a lot of work with compañeros or comrades in Mexico, particularly Oaxaca and Chiapas. We're very connected. And we do know that there is a very visible Afro-Mexican community in Guerrero on the Atlantic coast. But they're somewhat isolated and they're very discriminated against. We don't have very much direct contact with them, but we get a lot of information from the organizations that we work with in southern Mexico, particularly Ojos de Agua, which is an organization that right now is trying to figure out how to develop an exchange program and work with the communities in Guerrero. you know, we see that in Mexico there isn't any support on behalf of the federal government for Afro-Mexicans. And we, despite the fact that we don't have direct contact with that community now, we are trying to organize a visit to the Afro-Mexican communities. And regarding the people who immigrate from Honduras and the Garifuna in particular, oftentimes when they're crossing Mexico, people confuse them as African-Americans or blacks from the U.S. And so for some people, it's easier for them to cross into the United States. And others, it's still difficult because they go undocumented. And, you know, technically not everything is very bad in Mexico. There are people who are very strong solidarity activists who do work with us. But one of the things that we notice and that we share is that in Mexico, like in Honduras, there aren't public policies that are supporting our communities. And people migrate because they want to better their conditions. So they go to other countries because there really is no need for this migration if people had the conditions they needed and the support that they needed in their own countries. Because people really are, to cross Mexico, are risking their lives and dying. And really, it's just to fill the pockets of corrupt politicians and opportunists. And it's really a very painful issue. And to know that there's so much indifference on behalf of politicians, because really people are migrating because they're trying to resolve their issues, not because they want to cause any sort of damage here or problems in the U.S. And people work like donkeys and work terribly here, and oftentimes without the necessary resources and not up to living standards, because it's a necessity. It's a very delicate issue, and it's one of the issues that we work on and try and share as much information as possible about.
Right. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We're going to take a short station break, and when we return, we'll continue our in-studio discussion with Alfredo Lopez. He is the vice president of OFRENE, the Black Fraternal Organization of Honduras. He is Garifuna, people of African descent, based not only in Honduras, but in other parts of Central America. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Sojourner Truth. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Check us out on SoundCloud, on the SoundCloud website, and also on the Sojourner Truth website. Go to www.sotrueradio.org. Not only can you hear today's show, but also our back shows are archived on our website. A lot of other information you'll find there. And if you are a member of Facebook, like and friend us, please, on Facebook. We put a lot on Facebook that we're not able to get through during our regular show. Just look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. And our in-studio guest, Alfredo Lopez, vice president of OFRENE, the Black Fraternal Organization of Honduras. They work to protect and defend the Garifuna people's indigenous right to culture and their ancestral land along the Caribbean coast. Their communities have been caught in the midst of a violent militarized drug war and aggressive plans by transnational corporations to exploit mineral and oil resources, as well as to develop the tourism industry. He is the coordinator also of the Garifuna Community Radio. So as an alternative community radio, we're very happy to have you, Alfredo. Before we took our station break, we talked a little bit about perhaps some of the reasons for racism. And Alfredo, you talked about ignorance contributing to it. It is true that oftentimes we don't know enough about each other. But just pushing back a little bit on it, I wonder how much power, I think power also has a lot to do with it. And the fact that people identify with those that they see as the powerful in the world, controlling the resources, controlling governments, etc. And that also feeds into the kind of racism against darker-skinned people of African descent, of indigenous descent, wherever we are in the world. And I just wanted you to quickly respond to that. And then I do want to go on to talk about some of the more recent challenges of the Garifuna people.
Mm-hmm.
Una de las reuniones que hemos tenido acá en Los Angeles.
During this last visit that we've had in Los Angeles, we've taken up a lot of issues and we've spoken about discrimination, neoliberalism, colonialism, and how aggressive they've become, how much technology, resources, and mechanisms they use, such as the war on drugs. And these people who are in power are the ones who are deciding who are poor and which of the countries don't deserve respect, like the situation that our brothers and sisters face in Haiti, where there is an invasion going on with the so-called armed tourists, the MINUSTA, who are not welcome there and are very far from helping the people of Haiti. I actually had the opportunity to participate in COP16 in Cancun, Mexico, where I met a lot of our Haitian brothers and sisters who, at every protest that we had at this event, you know, repeated that the MINUSTA needs to leave Haiti and that the worst of it is that the United Nations lends their services to this type of occupation. And, you know, the real question is, why is it that in Haiti, if it's the most poor or impoverished and supposedly is facing these miserable conditions, why are they there? What are they doing in Haiti? Why is it so important? And this is one of the reasons why we stand in solidarity with our brothers and sisters in Haiti, because we're facing the same thing in Honduras. This so-called development, all it brings is death and discrimination and these public policies that threaten the very survival of our peoples. In Honduras, currently, they're privatizing our rivers, our beaches, our land. And the Garifuna people, we live off of fishing. Garifuna, without the beach or the water and a space to grow our crops, doesn't exist. And it's really what we're facing is the destruction of our culture. You know, I'm going to repeat this, which I've been saying a moment that I shared with an Italian senator a couple of years ago was what he asked me, what can we do to help you? And I've been sharing this story across my time here in the U.S. And, you know, there is something that you can do to help, I told him, is that you can look after the tax dollars that your people are paying and make sure they're not going to our government to destroy our communities. The Garifuna in 2001 was declared a cultural patrimony by UNESCO. And it's very critical for us that the money that people are sending internationally doesn't go to destroy our people. People pay their taxes, you know, on good faith, but a lot of this money that supposedly is going to address migration and poverty does everything but that. This money goes to paying military advisors, goes to death squads, and really is just continuing the destruction and war against our people. And every time that we can, we denounce this internationally.
Yes, our guest is Alfredo Lopez, Vice President of OFRENE, the Black Fraternal Organization of Honduras. He is Garifuna, very active, a leader in the Garifuna community in Honduras, and coordinator of the Garifuna Community Radios. And our translator is Jeanette Charles, who is with the Chiapas Support Group. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Alfredo, earlier, we talked about the assassination of the Honduras indigenous and environmental leader, Berta Cáceres. Now, about 2 years before she was assassinated, she pointed the finger at the U.S. State Department, in particular Hillary Clinton, for really legitimizing the military coup against the democratically elected president, Manuel Zelaya, that took place in 2009. And she did say that she relied on the counsel of Henry Kissinger, who was an orchestrator, for example, of the 1966 coup in Indonesia, where up to 2 million people were killed, and the 1973 coup in Chile, where thousands were killed and disappeared. I'm not asking you to comment on Hillary Clinton and that kind of U.S. internal affairs. There's a presidential election going on, and you are very active in the work in Honduras. But I do want you to comment a bit, though, on the African-American community here and the Garifuna community and the Afro communities generally in Central and Latin America. How important is it that Black people in the United States stand in solidarity with Black people in Central and Latin America? Clearly not only Black people, but just in terms of that particular relationship, because there have been several of us, including myself, that I've been concerned about a certain kind of lack of concern happening to our sisters and brothers across the border, and perhaps just only focusing on what's happening right under our noses or within our own communities, and even the recognition that right here in the Americas, they are people who are far more impoverished than some of the poorest communities within the United States. So when we talk about people being impoverished, it doesn't mean they're poor, like in Haiti. They've been impoverished. Haiti has the most impoverished in the Western Hemisphere. Honduras, the second most impoverished in the Western Hemisphere. A coup against both of those governments, right? So I just wondered if you would talk a bit about the importance in terms of a message you want to send to Black people living in the United States in terms of solidarity and concern for what's happening to the Garifuna and other people of African descent across the border.
Estamos iniciando recientemente.
Just recently, we have been meeting with members and leadership of Black Lives Matter during my last visit here in Minneapolis. And one of the agreements that we came upon is that we would continue to work together and collaborate. We're actually waiting for a delegation from Black Lives Matter to Honduras as well to visit our communities. Last, I also visited St. Louis, and there we organized a forum where I participated, representing the Garifuna people. The Black community of St. Louis participated as well, and the people of Palestine. And in conclusion, we all realized that we're in the same boat, and that it's necessary for us to strengthen our solidarity. Because, you know, the corporations are doing that. They're uniting and they're putting together their projects that are deathly for our communities. And so we have no other option but to unite and to strengthen our solidarity, our webs of solidarity. We can't just stand by and watch the destruction of our peoples and our communities. All of us are born with rights, the same rights that these same elite business people have. There's no reason why we shouldn't defend those rights. We do hope that people like Hillary Clinton and other elected officials do stop their politics that support coup regimes and allow for coups to happen. And we hope that with this upcoming administration that they review this political practice to stop meddling in business that has anything to do, nothing to do with the United States. And in effect, you know, we as an organization, as a Garifuna people, will continue to work with our Black and Indigenous brothers and sisters here in the United States. For example, the people of Palestine also have complete rights to defend their lands and to do what they want with their communities, and no one should impose upon them what to do. And we understand as well that there are different contexts here and in Honduras, but that regardless, we need to unite and build a united movement. And that the authorities shouldn't butt into our relationships and our coalitions because they have very different interests than what we do. Our interests are to defend ourselves. And, you know, what we need to do is unite and find our common interests as movements and peoples. But this is the struggle. And that's why we look for all the different ways that we can build our coalitions. That's why it's super important for us to come here. It's fundamental. It's critical to the work. Last, I met with a senator here from the United States, and she told me, you know, Alfredo, it's really important that you come here. You may not realize it, but people here do have power. They may not realize it either, but they have the power to pressure us in the Senate to make decisions, and that's the reality. So it's really important for us to come and to share experiences so people can pressure their elected officials so that they can do something about that and make changes, and that, you know, the work of lobbying and speaking with people on the Hill is very important, and to, so that we can also have face-to-face exchanges to facilitate that. It's also important for us, we believe, to share our experiences, our difficulties, and even our weaknesses so that we can learn how to strengthen and build with each other.
Our guest is Alfredo Lopez, Vice President of the Black Fraternal Organization of Honduras. He is an activist, a campaigner in the Garifuna community in Honduras, and also coordinator of the Garifuna Community Radios. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Alfredo, I now would like us to turn our attention to the organizing you and other Garifuna have been involved in on the ground in Honduras. And we covered the coup against Manuel Zelaya in 2009. when it was going on. We did a lot of coverage on Sojourner Truth throughout that whole process. And by the way, we also know that one of the reasons that coup in Honduras succeeded is because they did that coup in Haiti against President Aristide. And a lot of the progressives here in the United States, the left, as well as the Latin American nations, did not stand up against what they were doing against President Aristide in Haiti. Had they done that, I think they would have had more difficulty in pulling it off in Honduras. Now, there was an outcry when the coup happened in Honduras by some of the Latin American governments and the left here in the United States, much as it exists. But I wanted you to talk a little bit about the Garifunas, your role in that movement for democracy then in Honduras around that time of the coup. And we also know, as happened in Haiti, after the coup there against Aristide, there was a great repression that happened against the people. And we are wondering how the Garifuna community then was impacted in that period after the coup against Zelaya and the installation of the government following that coup. Alfredo.
Dos cosas importantes para aclarar para la gente que nos escucha.
So two things I want to clarify or emphasize is that there is a significant difference between President Zelaya and President Aristide. And though I don't know that much about the history of Haiti and Aristide, what I do know is Zelaya, and he was, you know, part of the country's elite families, and he came from a very economically powerful family. And it wasn't that he was promoting that many significant changes, but he did open a little window to social changes in the country. And that, you know, is different than the process that was happening under Aristide and Haiti. So what we had was something that looked a bit like democracy, or at least that's what they sold to us. However, when the coup happened, we did take over the streets, and we were in Tegucigalpa for more than 3 months, mobilized, trying to restore democracy in Honduras and the state. One of the reasons we were already mobilized in Tegucigalpa as well was because we were in negotiations with Zelaya's government. Because under his government, there were concessions to privatize our land. There were threats against our people. But he was willing to make changes. But what he did ask of us was to negotiate with his ministers, who many of the people in his cabinet had very strong ties to mega projects, to the business elite, to the international corporations. And, you know, we were in the negotiations for 2 years with his government. And when the coup happened, we realized that many of the people in his government were traitors to his own party. And, you know, it's not that Zelaya really helped us in particular, like our organization, Ofrane, and the Garifuna left in the country. But really, he helped more of the black right wing, or the Afro-Derecha, as we say in Honduras, because there is a division amongst our people. So one of the things I wanted to mention as to why there is a division between the left and the right in our communities, in the Garifuna people, is that actually this after the Haitian Revolution, 100 black monarchists of the Haitian elite were exiled to Honduras, and they were militarily trained. And to them, Honduras was a paradise because they were facing, you know, assassination by the people in Haiti for what they had done. And they were very well received in Honduras. And they were placed in Trujillo, which was the former capital of Honduras. And there, the Haitian monarchists mixed with some Garifuna people. And so now we have Garifuna who are descendants of these exiled Haitian elite. And their last names still stand, and you'll meet people who have direct lineage. And so, you know, there are some pros and cons to the process that we have in Honduras. And these aren't new details to us because we know where they come from. But one of the reasons why we continue to struggle and to organize is against these issues, right? One of the other things I wanted to speak to, particularly about the coup, was that after the coup, one of the things that happened was that we are now faced with a series of public policies that are threatening our communities, such as charter cities or model cities, which are the privatization of entire regions in the country. So now there are going to be complete areas of the country where they will have their own governors, their own laws, their own judges, their own police forces, etc. And literally what Honduras is doing is selling the country with us inside. And after the coup, this law is what was passed.
That's fascinating. History there can get really complex, to say the least. Our guess is Alfredo Lopez, vice president of OFRENE, the Black Fraternal Organization of Honduras, giving us some information that a lot of people don't know. I just want to underscore for our listeners that he just described Haitians, people of African descent, who were opposed to the Haitian Revolution and in support of Napoleon's army, who had to flee Haiti because the Haitian revolutionaries were not going to have it, would likely have their heads if they didn't flee, went to Honduras, and continued a history of a kind of a right wing within the Black population in Honduras. Talk about Black-on-Black crime. And this continues until today. But also, from what you're describing with this Model Cities-type project, is a kind of a balkanization of Honduras that's going on. I wanted you to build on that, to talk a bit more also connecting the Model Cities, but also the other ways that the Garifuna are losing their land. Who are some of the other people that you're up against, and what kinds of ways have you all been able to organize to resist this theft of Garifuna land and resources?
Una de las maneras que también estamos perdiendo nuestro territorio.
One of the ways that they also steal our land is through drug trafficking. Drug traffickers will buy our lands illegally, and they will grow African palm. Honduras, and the northern coast of Honduras in particular, is full of African palm plantations. From these palm plantations, the narco traffickers are no longer just drug traffickers, but they're now part of the business elite, and they have corporations. And so they're able to sell their products to the United States. And here, a lot of what's made from palm and processed is in products like Nestle, Kellogg's, and people buy this here because they have no idea where their products are coming from. And so every time we're here, we give a little bit more of these details because people genuinely do not know. And through this process, our communities are losing huge swaths of land. Another way that we lose land is when the government declares certain areas national parks or national reserves or protected areas. But what interestingly happens is that our elected officials then build their mansions in the middle of these reserves, and then they hire their own private military to protect their homes. So the political parties are the ones determining the laws, and we also have, for example, corrupt local officials like mayors who are selling our lands as well illegally. But we are always looking for ways to defend ourselves and to resist this land grab. Currently, we have two cases against the state of Honduras that recently came to an end with the Inter-American Court of Human Rights, who ruled in our favor, one with the community of Triunfo de la Cruz and the other with Punta Piedra, two Garifuna communities. In the 5 months that the sentence was delivered, the Honduran government has remained in silence. Also, there's another case against the Honduran government through the Inter-American Court of Human Rights with the four judges who were fired after they opposed the charter cities and said that they were unconstitutional. And, you know, what kind of democracy do we live in Honduras if the four judges who declared it unconstitutional were fired because of that very reason? The government, what they did was then replace these four judges with four that they preferred, who then quickly approved the law. And we met with those four judges who were fired in Guatemala, and they've told us that the Honduran government has also remained in silence, has not responded to the sentence. So for us, we're always continuing to organize, and one of the things that we're doing after this visit in Los Angeles is going to Washington to speak with senators to see if they can pressure our elected officials in Honduras to make some changes.
So very much the so-called drug war, or the war on drugs, impacting the Garifuna community, and you personally, I mean, you had a personal story. Perhaps you could just share a little bit about that, because certainly in the United States, there have been a number of cases of activists and militants, you know, being sent to prison unjustly. But you wound up having to spend some time in prison. So tell us about that, and also just looking at the clock here a bit about the work immediately that you're involved in. I mean, you just told us about some major victories that you all have had in regaining some of the Garifuna land. So clearly that's an ongoing struggle. But just tell us a bit about your time in prison and some of how the movement looks right now.
Really, yes, in effecto.
So we recently were in New York, where we participated in the Caravan for Peace and Justice that left Honduras on March 28th. And, you know, across Honduras and those of us that participated in the caravan, we've been victim to the war on drugs. I personally was incarcerated for 6.5 years, falsely charged with drug trafficking. And, you know, the same case I mentioned about Triunfo de la Cruz against the state of Honduras, my case was wrapped up into that case as well. And that was a 20-year-long case. Unlike a lot of our compañeros and compañeras that don't have luck being released from prison, I was able to, due to the amount, the significant amount of international pressure. Otherwise, I think I would have died in prison. To be locked up in Honduras is like being in hell. There's really no words to describe what I went through. You know, here in the U.S., Professor Chomsky, you know, who is here from the United States and a sociologist, talks about how the war on drugs is really a political ploy to criminalize the poor so that the corporations and the political elite can continue to fill up their pockets and, you know, carry out money laundering. And they have political concessions and financial concessions, and then they also finance political campaigns. And this isn't something I'm making up. It's just the reality of it. So it's really important that the war on drugs and the policies associated with that war are revised, because it's making our lives very difficult. You know, one of the women I met on the caravan, she's from Mexico, and she's lost 4 children due to the war on drugs, and she carries their pictures with her everywhere. And she reached New York without papers, which is the first time I've ever seen, you know, due to popular pressure. People linked arms and helped her cross the borders. And that's how she reached the United Nations, where we protested. We've really suffered due to the war on drugs. The drug presence here, for example, in other developed countries isn't going down. And, you know, really the political elite is just winning, earning more and more money from this war. Also in Honduras, we have this hotel chain called the Marbella that's, you know, based from European chains. And we also realized after 6 years that they had been money laundering in cahoots with the drug traffickers. You know, so I also, you know, Honduras has suffered, Hondurans have suffered, and, you know, on a personal level, my family really suffered a lot when I was incarcerated. So when Global Exchange approached our organization about participating in the caravan, we said yes. You know, and we are also, as an organization, in a battle against drug traffickers who illegally took over 1,200 acres of our land, where they even had an airstrip where they transported drugs towards the United States. So in the case of Vallecito, which is the land that I'm speaking of, we had to go personally to speak with then-President Pepe Lobo because the police and the military would not accompany us to recuperate our lands. They had to be forced to by the president to accompany us so that we were able to break down the drug traffickers' gates. And now, little by little, we've been able to reestablish our community there. We just recently won a Food Sovereignty Award in Ohio, and the president of our organization, Miriam Miranda, received this award on our behalf. But, you know, autonomy is something very difficult to build and really starts with producing what we need for our own nourishment. And that's a big piece of our work. And so we're committed to doing this work. And alongside that, we also focus on working with our young people and women who are very crucial to our resistance and guide our resistance. And, you know, the self-determination of our people and all peoples is really based in our education and our production and what we can produce to nourish our own homes.
On that note, I've looked at the clock, and I know you've got another event to get to. I'm afraid we have run out of time. There's so much more I wanted to discuss with you. We want to thank Alfredo Lopez, Vice President of OFRENE, the Black Fraternal Organization of Honduras. We'd like to thank Jeanette Charles kindly interpreting for us here today. I'm afraid we are out of time, though. Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us. We also want to thank the Sojourner Truth team, our longtime intern, Sherelle Withers, our Mr. T, Teddy Robinson, who engineers for the show, Stephanie Case, our assistant producer. We want to thank the Haiti Action Committee, the Chapas Support Group. We want to thank Nina Lopez of the Global Women's Strike, who coordinates work in Central and Latin America, for helping to inform us for some aspects of our discussion today. If you would like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
Cable Community Radio is proud co-sponsor of the Vanport Mosaic Festival, a four-day multidisciplinary event.